You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hi, everybody. Anna here. We are going to be taking the remainder of April off for various reasons, but mostly just to play catch up since a whole lot of life happened. All at the same time, we had the SAA conference. We're recovering from our various vaccine shots, and we've got a lot of stuff going on. But we're not totally going to leave you hanging. What we are releasing here is a cleaned up version of an episode of Dirt After Dark, which is one of our premium Patreon episode series that we do. If you're interested in joining our Patreon, signing up and getting access to some of the bonus episodes, plus a newsletter that you get every month telling you what we're up to, you can go to patreon.com/thedirtpodcast. Thank you all so much for listening, for understanding, for supporting us, and we will be back in May. We love you. Welcome to Dirt After Dark, the monthly bonus episode where we tell you the stories too spicy for the main feed. This one is one installment in a double feature for you listeners. So I'm going to tell Amber a story, and then in the second part, if you haven't listened to that one already, she returns the favor. So let's get into it. It's my turn.
It's and like actually Dirt After Dark because it's after like 4:57.
I know, it's dark here too. Winter is hard. I want to give the biggest of ups to Paul Cooper at Discovery Magazine's The Crux for 85% of this story. I tried to add a little of my own flavor, but, you know. For centuries, the medieval fishermen who sailed in the placid waters of Lake Nemi, 19 miles south of Rome, knew a secret. It was said that the rotting timbers of a gigantic ancient shipwreck lurked below the water's quiet surface. But the lake was tiny, with an area of only 0.6 square miles. Amber, I cannot emphasize enough how important it is that you keep in mind that this lake is so very, very tiny. Okay?
0.6 square miles.
It's very small.
So this is like that's a lake?
Well, I mean.
It's a pond.
Well, it's a big pond, small lake. I don't know.
Can we have a brief sidebar to talk about Lakeview Pond?
Yeah,
lake
sure.
It's by depth?
I think it must
be. Is
it
depth?
I have no idea because
I thought it was lakes have to be at least 50 feet deep.
I think, well, first of all, are there international standards? Second of all, it might be because we're going to talk about plumbing the depths. Also, my parents live right near a place called Farm Pond and it's massive. It must be. It should be a lake. So I don't really know. Anyway, it's very important for the purposes of this story that you remember that this lake is comically small.
The EPA's recommendation of 4 hectares, 10 acres, as the minimum surface area for a water body to still be considered a lake.
Yeah, but that's surface area.
The water, it's just, I'm trying to read you a series of sentences. The water must also be at least 3 meters deep, 9.5 feet, to ensure stratification.
Nothing.
So it's, okay, so it's got to be
9 feet
enough.
Deep?
No, I think the key part there was stratification. Like
having like stuff filtered down.
That you've got like your murky bits.
Yeah.
You've got your like, I don't know, pelagic clear, zone.
clear middle bits.
And then like the surface.
Right.
Yeah. And so I think that's what it is, but it's also surface area.
Interesting. But again,
we did not define ponds.
No. Well,
do you hear my dog?
I don't hear your dog, but I might when I edit.
You will. Because she's like circling me.
Well, I still am not sure that this is an international measure. And remember, we're in Italy. Anyway, this is a very small lake with no other body of water connected to it. So what could a vessel of such massive size be doing there? And yet, the stories about the gigantic ship persisted. Well, they couldn't have known then, but at the bottom of this tiny lake were 2 of the most unique artifacts ever to be uncovered from the ancient world. Their story would span millennia, bridging the eccentricities of Rome's most notorious emperor and one of the 20th century's most reviled rulers, only to be lost forever in the fires of war.
Wait.
Hmm.
This is really small. So small.
Yeah.
So was it bigger in the past?
Nope. Well, yes and no. We'll get to it. So the first reviled ruler was Gaius Caesar Augustus Germanicus. But if that name doesn't ring a bell.
Yeah, but it did.
You likely know his nickname, Caligula. There are very few surviving sources about the actual reign of Caligula, though he is described as a noble and moderate emperor during the first 6 months of his rule. Sort of goes downhill after that, and the sources focus upon his cruelty, sadism, extravagance, and sexual perversion, presenting him as an insane tyrant. I think one of the first things that I learned about Caligula was that he supposedly promoted his horse to Senate. It's hard to find good politicians. While the reliability of these sources is questionable, it is known that during his brief reign, Caligula worked to increase the unconstrained personal power of the emperor. It's probably also relevant that he was portrayed in Caligula, the only movie ever to be produced by Penthouse Magazine, a 1979 erotic historical drama film focusing on the rise and fall of the eponymous Roman emperor. You ready for this cast? The film stars Malcolm McDowell in the title role, alongside Teresa Anne Savoy, Helen Mirren, Peter O'Toole, John Steiner, and John Gielgud. And it is the only feature film ever produced by the men's magazine Penthouse. So that was 1979. That is much too recent history for our show. So let's travel back in time to the original Caligula, which translates to Little Boots.
Little Boots.
Little Boots. And the story behind the Lake Nemi shipwreck. Caligula, the real one, was born into the first ruling family of the Roman Empire, conventionally known as the Julio-Claudian dynasty. So remember, his name is...
It was the first one. It was the first dynasty.
That's what I said.
I must have been squeaking. That's fine. just... Sorry.
It's cool.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's fine. Germanicus's uncle and adoptive father, Tiberius, succeeded Augustus as emperor of Rome in 14 CE. So he was named after Gaius Julius Caesar, the original one. You may have heard of him. He acquired the nickname Caligula, meaning little soldier's boot, from his father's soldiers during their campaign in Germania. And when Germanicus died at Antioch in 19 CE, Caligula's mother Agrippina, not sure, returned with her six children to Rome, where she became entangled in a bitter feud with Tiberius. The conflict eventually led to the destruction of her family, quite literally, with Caligula as the sole male survivor.
Hang on.
Yes.
I'm sorry. So
Caligula's still a baby at this point, or he's a little kid.
Yes. Germanicus.
That's his dad.
Germanicus died. So he's named after him?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. He's named for Gaius Julius Caesar, but then his last name is Germanicus after his father.
My God.
Too many names.
Do you know how many semesters of Latin I've taken?
Roughly, yes.
And yet.
It's fine. It's been a while.
Did not.
Don't worry about it.
Man.
Certainly not the crux of this episode. Untouched by the deadly intrigues, Caligula accepted an invitation in 31 CE to join the emperor on the island of Capri, so Tiberius, where Tiberius had withdrawn 5 years earlier. And so...
Grotto.
Yes.
The art.
To his grotto with the art. Yes.
Was that the Laocoon?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wait. Wasn't Laocoon like in the grotto?
I think it might have been.
Because weren't this when the
you Google? I'll keep reading. Incidentally, Pliny the Elder, in some of his writings, called the Emperor Tiberius the gloomiest of men. So I'm sure it was a fun time. Following the death of Tiberius, though, were you right? I'm guessing you were right. Was Laocoon in the grotto?
So it was one of the Sperlonga sculptures.
Yes.
Which were at the grounds of the former villa of Tiberius.
Anyway, Caligula succeeded his adoptive grandfather as emperor in 37 CE. So that's how he got his rise to emperordom.
Mm-hmm. Emperordom, yes.
But Caligula was emperor for only 4 years, from 37 to 41 CE. But for various reasons, some of them, you know, true to history, his name has lived on due to a penchant for sadism, hedonistic excess, and brutality. He demanded to be worshipped as a living god, which isn't that different from what Roman emperors did anyway. Like they apotheosized after death anyway, right? They were raised to deities. So why not enjoy it during the lifetime, right? And he had the expensive taste to match. Records show that he emptied the imperial treasury in a single year with extravagant games and spectacles. Extravagant spectacles, including Big Ship, Tiny Lake. It seems Caligula may have built his ships, plural ships, on the tiny Lake Nemi due to its alignment with the goddess Diana Nemerensis, or Diana of the Wood, a fitting place for a living god to build his pleasure barges. And so here Caligula had two ships, but put a pin in that number, built at enormous expense. The largest, dubbed the Prima Nave. Amber, you want to flex that Latin?
Prima Nave.
Yeah,
well. First ship.
Yes. Was an enormous vessel, steered with oars 36 feet long. So like if the oars are 36 feet long, how big that ship?
Don't say that.
The second was a giant floating platform replete with marble palaces, gardens, and a system of plumbing for baths. The Roman historian Suetonius described the site of the ships, and I'm not going to be able to get through this sentence without laughing, so 10 banks of oars. I can't do it. The poops of which.
This is very similar to when Calypso ate some glitter.
The poops of which blazed with jewels. Yeah. Filled with ample baths, galleries, and saloons. Presumably salons. You know, like resting rooms. And supplied with a great variety of vines and fruit trees. This is on a boat in a tiny lake.
So dumb.
So quick reminder, this is a tiny lake, 0.6 square miles. There were two, at least, of these massive fancy floating palaces built here. So the lake was about 90% boat.
Related yes. to this, and like
glittery man's poops.
Eternal folly, Western man's eternal folly.
Yes.
Cruises, like cruise liners, mm-hmm. are like sort of like pound for pound, one of the like single biggest drivers of like emissions.
Ew.
Like they are like, yeah. like much bigger than flights.
Anyway, back to Rome. On these ships, which again take up most of this tiny lake, Caligula was reported to hold parties where his wild and licentious appetites ran wild. Cool sentence. With later historians repeating scurrilous and outlandish rumors about relationships with the wives of his generals and senators, and even with his own sisters. At least to some extent, you can believe the stories because he built these ships in the first place. Not necessarily the incestuous stuff, just like the scale of the partying. Despite their expense, these opulent palaces were afloat for only the briefest time. So they were only in use for about a year.
An exceptionally dry summer, and there was no more lake.
Well, there was no more Caligula, is actually what happened. About a year into the boat's use, Caligula's four-year reign came to an end. An alliance of senators and the Praetorian Guard ambushed him, stabbed him to death, thus perished Caligula. And attempts to restore the Republic after Caligula's death failed. Caligula's floating palaces, too, went the way of their creator. Their hulls were pierced and the immense ships were weighted with stones and sunk to the lake bottom. So, what happened after that? So, back to the top of this episode where I mentioned that medieval fishermen fishing in Lake Nemi kept saying, I think there's a shipwreck under here. I think there's a shipwreck under here. They did say it's like that. I'm Italian. It's a fine. In 1446, though, a young cardinal and nephew of the Pope, sure, named Prospero Colonna, decided to probe for himself the rumors of an unlikely shipwreck at the bottom of Lake Nemi. Unlikely because, again, it's a tiny lake. So he sailed out onto the lake, and sure enough, he could just make out a sprawling lattice of wooden beams. So he and his men tried to
He just looked into it and was like, huh, it's a boat.
Yeah. Well, it only has to be 9 feet deep. Those boats were probably mostly tall, you know, like probably sticking up out of the... I don't know. I don't know how deep Lake Nemi is, or at least how deep it was in 1446. We'll get to it. Prospero Colonna and his men tried to send down ropes with hooks on the end to retrieve parts of this mysterious structure, but at a depth of 60 feet, so it's at least 60 feet deep.
It's 108 feet deep.
It is now, but hang on. Hold that thought. They didn't have much luck. All they managed to do was tear off some planks. So Colonna had confirmed that the wreck existed, minus a few planks now. But from there, the mystery only deepened. So fast forward 100 years or so. In 1535, Italian inventor Guglielmo de Lorena and his partner Francesco de Marchi, returned to the wrecks with a new and exciting technology, a diving bell. So they descended through the murk and gloom and saw an enormous wooden superstructure far vaster than anything they had imagined.
This is some James Cameron shit.
Yeah, 1500s James Cameron.
Giacomo.
I was going to say Giacomo, but that's not right. Is that Giacomo? Is it James? Giacomo Cameroni. Cool. The two fished around the bottom of the lake for artifacts, and they managed to bring up sculptures made of marble and bronze scattered on the muddy lake bottom. And so many others tried to explore and survey the wrecks, but without much success. So after 1535, Amber, can you guess which famous Italian was the one to finally reveal the sunken pleasure barges? Can you think of a historical figure, an Italian one, one that might be, say, obsessed with the legacy of ancient Rome?
I can.
Yup. It's that one. The ships
Uncle Benito?
The ships were an obsession for fascist dictator Benito Mussolini. He worked hard to include its archaeological remains in his cult of personality.
They just love that.
They love it.
Fascists love the past.
They do. Mussolini had embarked on ambitious projects around Rome. He was frequently described in propaganda dispatches as a new Augustus, because the old one went great, evoking the Roman emperor who rebuilt much of the city during his reign. It was only a matter of time before the dictator's attention turned to the mysterious ships at the bottom of Lake Nemi, because there were records by this point, records of the diving bell and records of previous attempts to survey the ships.
So and they're probably still, like,
still visible. Yep.
Yeah, it's like, on a clear day being like,
So this is why I kept saying, I don't know what the lake was like then. Because in 1929, Mussolini ordered the whole of Lake Nemi to be drained. So engineers reactivated an existing ancient Roman cistern together with a modern pump that reduced the lake's water level by 65 feet. So in the mud, slowly emerging from the waters, the Italian engineers found not one, but two enormous shipwrecks. And the excavations would take years, with the second ship not brought up until 1932. So now I can finally tell you how big these ships were.
How big were they?
The ships were vast, among the largest ever recovered from the ancient world. The largest was 240 feet in length, the same length as an Airbus A380. So, like,
those have the roomy seats.
Those are the ones with the aisle seats, like the middle row of seats. Yeah.
And the seats are bigger.
And measured 79 feet across.
Oh my God.
From inscriptions on lead pipes and tiles, it soon became clear that what had been discovered were in fact the floating pleasure palaces of the infamous first century Roman emperor Caligula. Until the discovery of the Nemi pleasure barges, it was thought that the Romans were incapable of building such large vessels.
Why? What? I mean, they did, like, you know, concrete and aqueducts.
They did underwater concrete. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And, like, roads to everywhere.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know why this was a particular sort of breaking point for believability, but historians had assumed that measurements of up to 164 feet given for grain-carrying vessels in some ancient sources were exaggerations. I think primarily because they've never been found, these giant ships. Probably because they were broken down for parts after they were, you know, after they served their usefulness. The Nemi ships show they may have been real, although this is like a bizarre example. Like, this is, these ships are not good examples of, like, it's good examples of the technological capabilities of Romans.
That, like, they could have, but maybe they didn't normally.
Because it's not like these vessels needed to be seaworthy. Although, wait till the next paragraph, because it's so dumb. While excavating at Lake Nemi, Italian archaeologists uncovered a veritable treasure trove of artifacts from the wrecks. Why do you have to say veritable? It was just a treasure trove.
I mean, but it is truly that.
Truly. Vast anchors, bronze mouldings, and marble statues came up from the depths, along with ornamental ore rings and joints in copper and bronze. So, like, joints as in the things that held the planks of the ship together.
Yeah.
Yeah. They found carvings and mosaics, put a pin in those mosaics, even gilded copper roof tiles that would have shone spectacularly in the sun. The expense,
so tacky.
It's hideous. The expense of the vessels would have been enormous. And here's a special little detail. The wooden beams of the ships were even coated with lead, a costly treatment designed to protect seagoing vessels from shipworms. Lake Nemi is a freshwater lake. Shipworms don't live in freshwater. So they went ahead and coated these boats in lead, just because.
They got an invasive species.
Yeah, sure. So these are the ships that Mussolini found. And so for him, the recovery of these ships was a significant triumph, not to mention it came along with a whole bunch of shiny statuary and stuff. So as the mud-soaked wrecks rose out of Lake Nemi, it seemed a good metaphor for his promises to revive the legacy of ancient Rome in the modern day.
Not a bad metaphor.
It's a metaphor. He had a huge museum built in 1936 to house the wrecks so that the public could visit. But Mussolini, like Caligula, would soon face a fitting downfall, hanging from a lamppost. And the Nemi ships would follow him into the ashes of history, which is a real shame.
I didn't realize that...
he excavated them.
That there was, like, actual, like, archaeology done.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, sort of by contrast, I don't think, like, the Nazis did, like, great archaeology.
Not in a science-y way, more in an artifact-y, grabby kind of way.
Yeah, like, it was, like, more... And I thought that Mussolini was more in the realm of, like, collecting and well, sort of, like...
really what this was. But he did, at least built a museum for... But it was all about propaganda, really.
Yeah.
I don't know how... I genuinely don't know how much scientific exploration went into this project, or if it was just about excavating and then displaying.
So interesting.
Yeah. And... a real shame, because on the night of May 31st, 1944, less than 4 years since Mussolini entered the Second World War in support of Hitler's Germany, Italy was on the brink of defeat. The country had nearly capitulated and had been invaded by Nazis to prevent their resistance from collapsing. But the Germans were on a multi-front retreat across all of Europe, and Allied troops were closing in. Incidentally, have you ever read about Mussolini's son? He was a really famous jazz musician, and he disavowed his father, and he eventually wrote a book called something like My Life as Mussolini's Son, or yeah, I don't remember what it was called. But he was a really, really well-known jazz musician in the 40s and 50s.
And his name was just like
Luca, I think, Mussolini. I think he changed his name.
He changed it, yeah.
Yeah, but it was something like Rodolfo Mussolini. I did not Google this in preparation for sharing this fact with you. But that's really interesting to me because of how much the Nazis hated jazz. Because not only was it black people music, but it was like chaotic and not mm-hmm. ordered, and it was improvisational. And that's very not German. So it's not known whether the fires in the museum started as a result of U.S. artillery or German arson, because Nazi troops frequently set fire to positions they abandoned, salting the fields kind of thing, blowing up bridges on the retreat and doing anything they could to slow the advances of the Allies. Either way, the Nemi ships burned. Only some bronzes survived, along with a handful of photographs of the colossal wrecks. So if you go to the links that we'll have in the show notes, you can see some sort of vintage photos of Mussolini himself touring the exhibits. So like Caligula, Mussolini met an ignoble end. Less than a year after the ships burned, he was shot while fleeing Italy in disguise. And 2 days later, Hitler also took his own life. So today, the ghosts of the Nemi ships live on only in their photographs and the very few remaining artifacts that survived the fire. But wait!
So
it gets tackier.
If it weren't for Mussolini, like, lowering, like, dredging, sort of draining this lake.
If it weren't for Mussolini and pulling them out, the ships would have probably survived to some extent. Like, whatever damage they would have gotten from being underwater added to that. But yeah, they'd be there.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true for, like, a lot of
Absolutely.
A lot of stuff from the ancient world, like through like World Wars 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. Like a ton of stuff got destroyed. A lot of stuff went missing. A lot of stuff was destroyed.
Not just ancient artifacts, stuff like Peking Man, the Java Homo erectus skull.
That's right.
Was on a World War 1, 2. It was on a boat that was torpedoed, probably. It just sort of went missing.
That's another Clive Cussler book, isn't it?
Oh, God, is it? Oh, no.
I think so.
I don't want to. Is that a movie? I don't want to watch it.
It's not a movie.
Good.
Because it didn't get off the ground. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know why.
So but, we're continuing in our funneling from exceptionally tacky to fascism. Well, that's a bummer. To tacky tiny fascism? And tacky. Huh? Oh. No.
It's like tacky fascism.
Well, no, just I want to see how you react to this because it's okay. Just absurd. So this last bit is from the Washington Post. When Mussolini launched his ambitious project to salvage Caligula's pleasure barges, Lake Nemi was only partly drained. And in the decades since, rumors have persisted that the remains of a third 400-foot-long pleasure ship lurk in the deepest part of the lake. First of all, how?
The deepest part being 100 feet.
Now, first of all, the idea of a third ship in that lake is very funny, but it's not completely out of the realm of possibility because local fishermen report getting their nets snagged in that area of the lake only to bring up Roman artifacts. So it's very possible that stuff from the two ships kind of got scattered over a wider area, but maybe. Alberto Bertucci, Bertie Bert, the mayor of the town of Nemi, said in 2017, quote, "We know from documents from the 15th century that one of the boats went down in an area of the lake different to where the other two were found during the fascist era," end quote. Okay, so the 15th century was 1,500 years after this happened. So, like, how would you know where the boats went down? You don't know. I don't know. Luigi Datola of the Environmental Protection Agency of Calabria said that this gradually evolved into something more, saying, quote, "We decided to dive further and search for the mysterious ship. Although it might seem bizarre that three huge ships would float upon such a small lake, yes, the fact that the vessels belonged to Caligula makes the scene likely," end quote. So just Caligula's reputation makes anything absurd seem just like, yeah, sure. Datola and his colleagues have used side-scan sonar and sub-bottom profiling. Sub-bottom profiling. I'm an adult. To search the mud at the bottom of the lake. And he says that they've already noticed some features that look interesting, and police divers will examine them for clues to the third vessel's location. Okay, so this news was from 2017. I was unable to find any confirmation that a third ship of any sort had been found in Lake Nemi. But I did find a little tidbit that makes for a nice, if silly, coda to this story from thevintagenews.com. It was recently revealed that a large piece of marble mosaic that was part of a pleasure barge built for Caligula has served as a coffee table in the Park Avenue home of a New York City antiques dealer. Helen Fiorati said, quote, "It was our favorite piece, and we had it for 45 years, end quote. The Italian government, though, had other ideas.
The part that I'm supposed to react to?
This is so dumb. The multicolored mosaic was removed from the Fiorati home and is now back in Italy. It was once proudly displayed in an art museum devoted to Caligula's ships, financed by Benito Mussolini. So there's the coming full circle. But the mosaic disappeared from the museum either before or during World War II, since the museum burned to the ground in 1944.
Sure, didn't happen after.
Nope. Fiorati said she and her husband, journalist Nereo Fiorati, bought the mosaic from an aristocratic Italian family in the late 1960s. The sale was facilitated by an Italian police officer. And she said, quote, "This was an innocent purchase," end quote. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office seized the mosaic as part of an initiative to return stolen Italian artifacts found in the U.S. using evidence supplied by art experts and the Carabinieri Police Force of Italy, specialists in hunting for artifacts. Other pieces have been returned as well, including ancient coins, books, and even an Apulian red figure vessel dated to around 350 BCE, which was found at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Which was found. Oh, what's that? Just came lurking out of a corner.
No, district. That's where you would find, like, you know, human remains. Mm.
Too real. District Attorney Cyrus Vance, comic book character Cyrus Vance, said, quote, "Returning lost relics to their rightful owners is at the core of my office's mission to end the looting of rare cultural treasures and trafficking of stolen antiquities. These items may be beautiful, storied, and immensely valuable to collectors, but willfully disregarding the provenance of an item is effectively offering tacit approval of a harmful practice that is fundamentally criminal," end quote. So there we have it. This journey from absurd Roman pleasure barges to fascist fanboys to archaeological attempts to low-key coffee table crime. That is the journey that I have chosen to take you on.
Wow.
And all on this tiny, tiny lake.
Oh, it's, yeah. Big boat, tiny lake.
Yeah. It's, you'd love to see it.
Man, I hate rich people.
Ow.
There are no heroes in this story.
There are no heroes in this story except perhaps the
fisher persons.
Yeah, the fisher persons.
Like, I think there's a boat down there.
Yeah, they're just like, Mamma Mia.
I...
Na way. Latin joke. Did I title this Sorry to Barge In, or did you?
I think you did.
I have no recollection of doing job. That.
I like squawked when I opened it, because when I opened it I only saw like Dirt After Dark, like, so, and like clicked on it and I was just like, what a treat. But I like
apart okay does, but apart from your distaste for rich people,
I find it really fascinating that, so this is something that the folks at, come on, help me out.
I have no idea where you're going, so I can't help you with where you are.
The guy that
Damien Huffer?
The guy, no. Oh. The guy that, like, basically, like, tracks the co-opting of, like, classical, like, rhetoric and art and archaeology in the far right. And, like...
Yeah.
I cannot remember the Latin name for it.
The
name for it, but it's based at, we'll find it, we'll put it in the show notes, but it's based at Vassar, mm-hmm. based at Wellesley, mm-hmm. it's at another seven sibling school. People love harking back to the
Pharos.
The Roman Empire, Pharos, yeah. Thank you,
Google.
Like, people love talking about Rome. Like, specifically Rome. Americans love talking about Rome.
Because our founding fathers were educated in the classics.
Yeah. So that, I mean, this, like, one of the lessons here is that you should never trust a classicist.
Or a Greek bearing gifts.
Yeah. Okay.
Trojan horse.
I know.
Okay.
But it's something that, like, I don't know, like, Mussolini being, like, so horny for, like, the Roman Empire and, like, going at, like, it's just, like, I don't know, it's so, it feels so on the nose. It's just, like, read the room. Like, it didn't work out great.
Well, that's the thing. It's selective, it's entirely selective sort of blindness to everything that didn't go well for the ancient Romans and focusing on, you know, his desire to return Italy to some form of glory, the thing that he could latch onto, because Italy hadn't really had a period of glory, except for, I guess, the Renaissance, which was kind of great. But even the Renaissance had its foundations in resurrection of the classics.
Yeah.
So
it's
cyclical.
And it's just,
I don't know. It was the thing that he could latch onto that especially in terms of militaristic success and glory.
Yeah. And I guess, like, it makes sense that, like, fascists love a pretty fashy thing, which was, like,
literally fascists,
like the empire. Yeah. And
the people who developed fascism the first time.
Yeah. I think it's, yeah. Like the, yeah. I think that the fact that after Caligula's removal from office, they attempted
his mishap with several knives.
Yeah. They attempted to resurrect the Republic, right? They tried to
sort of unsuccessfully, but the military was like, nah.
Yeah. Because they're like,
We're the ones with the swords.
We love this.
Yeah.
It's great to be us. And as long as we are still us, it's pretty great. I don't know. I think about fascists a lot. I think about fascism a lot.
I think why.
It's real. You know, I think that we should have Sacco and Vanzetti Day and like celebrate Italian American heritage that day and like completely cede Columbus Day over to Indigenous Peoples Day. Because like 100%. Those are the folks that like are apart from the Owen Benjamins of the world who think that like who are just like out there trying to like own the libs and like talking about like why like Columbus was good. Apart from that very small percentage of people, a lot of people are attached to Columbus Day because of Italian American heritage. And like
there's so many better Italians.
I know. And like I get it. Like I get why Italian Americans would want to have a day like about being Italian American. Yeah, because absolutely. Like for a long time, like being Italian American was being
non-white, essentially.
Yes. Yeah. And so like and that's something I'm very aware of. Yeah. And so like having that is great. And that's why I think we should have Sacco and Vanzetti Day. Not only because like solidarity, but also like they did not commit a crime.
No, they did.
And they were murdered by the state because they were falsely accused because they were Italian.
Yeah.
I'm
on board.
Like, yeah, that is who we should be having like Italian American heritage.
Not
the guy who like was a slaver. Like, let's not.
Yeah. Remember how Queen Isabella was like, "Ooh, no, don't take slaves." And he was like, "Cannot hear you over the sound of me enslaving people."
I know.
What? We've said this before, like, but
I feel like I wish I had like new responses to things instead of like, I hate the rich. And also like, this is the wrong Italian.
That's fine. You know, it's in your sack of things that you pull out, you know, it's in your arsenal.
This is in my, you know, the old like turn of phrase, sack of things you pull out.
My brain short circuited. Could you hear the grinding like noise? It was like, oh no, I don't know the words.
Seized up.
I just wanted you to laugh at these silly, silly boats with me.
Oh no. I can laugh and also hate the rich.
Oh yeah, no.
But no, those things exist in me. But the thing that I'm really just like, I don't know, very struck by is like Mussolini like did an archaeology.
He did.
And then it was like destroyed.
I know. Well,
of things of value to like human heritage.
So there's that.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad we finally did this episode.
Yeah. And I'm glad that I could sort of weave so many dumb things in there.
It's just.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed whatever this journey was. And we'll be back with you soon. Goodness knows with what. But we hope you'll enjoy it. Thank you for your support, as always. I'm just going to include the next 40 minutes of Amber cackling to herself.
Yep.
Bye.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.